the weather or the parking. I'm not sure which it is, you know. I think the parking, more than anything else. It's rather frightening to know that if you pull out of your space, you don't know if you're ever going to get it to find another one. So, you know, the world says there was a preacher in the Midwestern United States, and he showed up 1 week and there was a huge storm, and only one gent showed up for the service. So he goes over to him and he says, "Joe, what do you say? Should I proceed or not?" So he says, "Reverend, let me tell you," he says, "if only one cow comes for dinner, I still feed him. I don't send him home hungry." So the preacher goes up and he says a sermon for 2 hours. When he finishes, the preacher says to him, "Joe, what do you say?" He says, "Reverend, if only one cow shows up, I don't dump the whole load on him." Fortunately, by the media that we have today, so those that haven't attended, their greatest loss will be that they cannot ask questions. They'll have to live with the questions of others. But by sometime tonight, it'll be on the blog in Torah Anytime, and people all over tune in on the Shiurim. So those that don't come, I haven't been able to come, we'll have to pick it up on the blog. I would like to dedicate the shiur this evening to the Refuah Shleima of two children who need a Refuah Shleima, Chana Basara Rivka and Yeshua Bas Rishali Oira. They should both have a Refuah Shleima from Heira, Be'ezus Hashem. The Ribbono Shel Olam's Torah is a constant, it's unchanging. But yet, the halachas that we confront b'chol dor b'dor are different. Not that the halachas are any different, but we face different situations with different halachas b'chol dor b'dor. Because the sociological circumstances of our times change. The types of places we live in, the way society is organized, the economics of society, and a generation back, this would not have been a very significant share. My mother, Aleha Shalom, was not at work from the time that my oldest brother was born until my youngest sister had entered high school or was just about to enter high school. She was home. Some 20 some odd years. Consequently, what might happen to the kashrus of one's house if some non-Jewish person was there unsupervised, there was no such thing. Never happened. But the world has changed significantly to the largest extent. Almost all women are out of the house significant amounts of time during the day. It's the nature of the times in which we live. And consequently, we have all types of people running around the house. We have babysitters running around the house, cleaning people running around the house, and sometimes even repair people that we're used to, we know them, and we might allow them access to the house. You know, we can't wait for them to come at 8 o'clock at night when we decide to come home. They're not going to come at that hour. Something's broken, needs to be fixed. We have to arrange for them somehow. Either we trust them enough to give them access, or we allow someone else to open the door and let them in, and they come. And all of these create a situation that our kitchens are unsupervised. Now, we're not even dealing with the question of anything malicious. It's the question of being malicious. My point of departure, very clear in my mind, years back when I was learning in yeshiva, a repairman came to the yeshiva building one morning and he was fixing the refrigerator, whatever he was fixing. And in the middle of his work, lunchtime came. So he's been in a million kitchens in his life. That's where his venue is to do his work. He took out a sandwich, sausages. He put it into the oven. He turned the oven on and he warmed the sandwich up. He'd done this probably hundreds of times in his life. This is a normal thing to do. What kitchen where he's working, in fact, for the people in the kitchen, wouldn't they let him warm a sandwich up? I mean, how indecent could you be? And here it was, right smack in the shoe, a tray of a sandwich was warmed up in one of the ovens, and now it was treif. So there's not even a question of being malicious. Called to the kitchen two years back about yeshiva. They have a deep fat fryer to make falafel balls, to make French fries. So the one that runs the kitchen calls me and he has a problem. He says the fryer wasn't working, so he called the repair service to come. So how do they determine what the problem is? Well, first you put on the machine, you heat it up. Then he pulls out a thermometer, stuffs it into the oil, places it into the oil to see how hot the oil is getting. He wants to understand what the nature of the problem, how severe the problem is, and what has to be done about it. There's probably about 30 quarts of oil in this machine on a normal day. So he comes to ask me, what's he supposed to do? He says, I can't begin to imagine where else this thermometer has been. And, you know, he's not a firm person, not even a Jewish person. He comes and he fixes kitchen equipment. And this is one of his basic tools. Pulls out a food thermometer and puts it into a fryer to see what's happening. So we're not dealing with the question of being malicious. Those that haven't worked closely with us have no idea what we want. Haven't the foggiest. I was once called to a health-related facility, people that I know that own it, and they had a problem. It's a glatt kosher facility. The kitchen staff was in a perennial war with the nursing staff. Why? Because the kitchen staff delivers the meals to the floors, and the nursing staff has to give it out. And the dealing reminder was all non-Jews. The kitchen staff was also all non-Jewish. Not a single Jewish person was there. What was their problem? They understood the difference between milchiks and fleishiks. And they didn't want the nursing staff mixing everything together. And the nurses thought that these guys were just harassing them. What in the world are they on from our life? You know, dirty dishes, we've got to load them up and get them out of here. That's it, to keep the place sanitary. What in the world are they on from us? So I actually went and met with the entire nursing staff to explain to them what's going on and what the Hispanic guys working down in the kitchen, what they want from you. So we're dealing in a situation, as I said, we're not dealing with anyone malicious. It's not a question of being malicious. It's a question that which we need, they don't begin to understand. And things which, from their standpoint, can be anything other than totally innocent, for us, are very harmful. So that's what tonight's share is about. And I think the number one place, before we talk about anything else, the number one issue, more than anything else, of all the shyness that I get from people that have problems in the house, microwaves are the first and foremost problem. This is every time, almost constantly, when I have problems with people with help that are in the house, and they warm something up, they put it into a microwave, they warmed up their food, and they sat down to eat, and then the balabusta realized, and she calls me up, Rabbi, what do I do now? This is a constant problem. If you have some means, if you're not home, of closing down your microwaves, go down and take the switch, the circuit breaker, and close it. Render them inoperable. You will have solved probably the greatest majority of shyness that you're going to have in your house. The greatest majority of your shyness that you're going to have in the house. So that's number one. Microwaves are a source of a great deal of problem. Things get hot in a microwave. Things drip in a microwave. And then we put our plates directly in contact with who knows what. So that's first and foremost, is to establish control of the microwave. Now, we need also to ask ourselves what responsibilities we're giving people that come to work in our home. Do we want them to cook for us or for our children? Do we want them to warm up the food? What do we want from them? And we have to realize the potential pitfalls that may in fact arise if they're using things in our house. My daughter was in a day camp many, many years ago, upstate in the Catskills, a day camp in one of the bungalow colonies. She had a job. And the counselors realized, it's a very Haredish bungalow colony. This is universal. It has nothing to do where you are on the spectrum of Frumkeit. From one end to the other, this problem exists. They realized that there were many homes that they couldn't eat the food in. Why? Because people would go away and leave her for a 2-3 days vacation with the wife, and leave their live-in together with the children, and she cooked the food for the next 2 or 3 days. And even assuming that she didn't trafe the place up directly, she didn't put butter into the chicken soup or on the steak, even if she knew that. But what happened to the Bishul Akum problems? Now, Bishul Akum means when a non-Jew cooks food, it's a very serious issue. Because if we violate Bishul Akum, we'll talk about what some of the things are to be sure that we don't violate, but if we violate Bishul Akum, the food is rendered non-kosher, number one. Secondly, the second consequence of that is, well, if I have a plate or a pot that has non-kosher food in it, and it's heated, the food in that pot, that pot or dish is also non-kosher now. So it's not only the food itself that remains as the problem, but the problem is what comes in the wake of that is that the utensils that they leave behind also have to be kashered. So this is not, you know, a simple problem. Not at all a simple problem. And then there's another aspect to the problem, which we need to understand a little bit of background in the laws of Yerodea to understand this. We have throughout Kashrus of the whole year, we're not talking about Pesach, but Kashrus of the whole year, there are a couple of major safety valves which allow Rabbonim to deal with most of the issues that arise and to find that they actually remain mutter. The biggest and the foremost throughout the year is the fact that any utensil which wasn't used for the last 24 hours cannot render something non-kosher. So you come and you call me up one day, you took out your kids took out the fleishig pot and they put a milchik of corn soup in it and they warmed it up. And then they dumped it into your plates, and they took the spoons, and it's a levedik. So what do we do now? So if the pot wasn't used in the last 24 hours, so the food is kosher, and all the utensils are kosher, the pot itself will still need to be kosherized, to be kashered. Now, within the laws of Yerodea, we have the following. Suppose I cooked meat today in the pot. Tomorrow, I cooked pasta in the pot. Right? So last night, I cooked meat. 12 hours later, I cooked pasta. And 25 hours after the meat, my kids came and they threw milchiks into this pot. Since the elapsed time between the time the meat was used in this pot and the dairy was used in this pot is more than 24 hours, is not a problem, despite the fact that the pot was used for hot power of food in the interim. That's true when you're dealing with kosher things. When you're dealing with non-kosher things, life is not so simple. Every time you reheat the pot, the clock gets reset to zero. So, if you have a pot and you cook non-kosher in it, now you cooked something even kosher in it, whatever it may be, cooked water in it, the clock gets reset in the morning. We started last night. This morning I cooked pasta in the pot. So the non-kosher clock, 24-hour clock, gets reset this morning. In other words, I cooked fleishiks last night and milchiks tonight, 25 hours later, and I cooked pasta this morning, midway in between the 2 points. So the clock kept running. So by the time it was 8 o'clock last night, it's now 8 o'clock tonight, I'm clear. I cooked the pasta, the milchiks at 9 o'clock, it's kosher. Long as there was 24 hours in between the meat and the dairy. But if I cooked non-kosher last night at 8, at 8 o'clock this morning I cooked pasta in the pot, and now 9 o'clock tonight I cook some more meat in the pot, kosher meat. So it's 25 hours since the non-kosher was cooked in the pot. But it's only 13 hours since I cooked up that pot this morning at 8 a.m. to cook pasta in it. When I cook it up the pasta by non-kosher, the 24-hour clock gets reset to zero. So I have to go from this morning, 8 o'clock, not till tonight, 8 o'clock, but till tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock. So if I keep using this pot again and again within 24 hours, the clock constantly gets reset to zero. So this is a major, major complication in kashrus, that if non-kosher gets cooked in one of my pots, and even if I don't, as long as if I didn't wait 24 hours in between uses, so every time I cook in less than 24 hours, the clock gets set again to zero.
Because you could use the pot.
I didn't know about it. I found out later. I couldn't use it, but I didn't know about it. Tonight I figured out that last night what happened. Yeah, the goiter cooked, tray for food in my pot last night. So now I cooked food tonight in my pot. It's 25 hours since she cooked her food, but it's only 13 hours since I used the pot again to cook pasta this morning. The pot remains treif. It needs 24 hours of non-use to get reset to zero. So this is a major, major complication of having something treif take place in the house. You can kosherize it, but we're dealing with the food itself. Every time that it will have the ability to keep rendering the food treif, even though it's more than 24 hours since the treif was used in this pot. And normally that's what resolves most of the problems. 90% of the shaylos that I get concerning the pot was used for the milchiks, for the fleishiks for the milchiks, 90% of the shaylos are resolved with the answer to one question. Was it used within the last 24 hours for hot fleishiks or hot milchiks? The answer is no. Shalom Yisrael. The food is kosher. The pot has to be kosherized. The food remains kosher. The dishes are kosher. The spoons are kosher. The serving utensils are kosher. Just the pot has to be kosherized. That's 90% of the time what happens. But it doesn't work by treif. The clock can constantly be reset. So this is a major, major complication. So we need to ask ourselves how we set ourselves up in the first place to make sure it doesn't happen. Now, there are a lot of practical things that we should do to try to lessen the problem. But at the bottom line, what we really need to do is the following. Is we have to establish some hashgacha for our house. Some hashgacha for our house. Whether our husband is around to come in during the day, our daughter is around, whoever it is, a relative is around, somebody has to come and give him the key, and they should just march and tell that you help, that somebody may come, one of your relatives is going to march into the house from time to time so they don't keel over from fright, when somebody marches in on them. But one has to establish hashgacha on one's house. That's the bottom line. That is a lot of things we have to do along the way to lessen the impact of any potential, to make it much less likely that we're going to have problems in the first place. And that's some of the things that I do want to discuss. Now, before we deal also with what they may do in the kitchen, there's another whole major area that we need to turn our attention to, and this has become more complex in the last few years. Now, we know in the handling of wine, so there's a major distinction between wine that's mevushel, that's been cooked, and wine that's non-mevushel, which hasn't been cooked. Now, the Epicurean among us, like Yayin Sheino mevushel, they say it's better. It's a higher class of wine. So, we have to ask ourselves, are we going to have non-Jewish people or non-frum people around the house when this wine is in use? Now, some people want to have this wine not only for Epicurean reasons, but yeah, the halacha says there's an advantage to using non-mevushel wine for Kiddush and Avdolah. So we want to have non-mevushel wine. Now, every time we decide in halacha Rabbi Machmer, which is a very nice and noble thing often, but we need to ask ourselves, what are the possible downsides of this chumrah that we have undertaken to make sure that we've calibrated it properly, that we'll gain by what we're doing, we'll be in fact more meticulous about the kashrus, and not less meticulous. Now, this can happen in all types of ways. Now, what became increasingly difficult in this area is because of the quest of many to use non-mevushel wine for Kiddush. There arose the quest of many to use non-mevushel grape juice for Kiddush and Avdolah too. Now, the large glass bottles of grape juice from Kedem are non-mevushel. They're not mevushel. And I rather nicely admonished one of the people responsible, one of the rabbanim responsible for this, that if he wants to have such a product, he should do me a favor, please. And if it works, and keep it in Williamsburg, if it works for them. But please not to send it here, but to no avail. Because I said, it doesn't work in my part of town. You have a bottle of grape juice. Now, most people don't even imagine that grape juice could be non-mevushel. Grape juice was pasteurized. This was always the one thing that was always mevushel, was grape juice. So you take a bottle, you pour in, you make Kiddush Shabbos, you made Avdolah Motzei Shabbos. What do you do with it? It's open. You don't want it to mold. You put it into the refrigerator. And you march out of the house. Your cleaning lady comes, and she's there with it. So, in all probability, what's going to happen, you're going to wind up pouring it down the drain. But worse than that is if you don't realize, and you don't pour it down the drain, the next Shabbos you're making Kiddush on it. But now it has the halach of Stam Yenu. So, I had a quest, in fact. My initial purpose was to be more meticulous about the halacha, to use Yayin Sheino mevushel, which is an advantage, undoubtedly. But what did I wind up doing? Instead of that, I wound up making Kiddush next Friday night on wine, which is treif. So, the chumrah didn't work well for me. I paid too big a price for it. You know, I trashed the din for the sake of attempting to be more meticulous. So if I'm living in that situation that I have a non-Jewish person, particularly a livin, that's always around, it's very, very hard to deal with it. You probably shouldn't be bringing anything wine that's not mevushel or grape juice and not mevushel into your house. If you have once in a while a bottle, then you have to be careful to put it in some place where they will not normally go to. You know, and it's something that's considered a place that's considered out of bounds for them. Yeah.
What exactly is the problem? Are they not allowed to look at it, touch it?
It goes like this. There are two things they're absolutely not allowed. They are not allowed to pour it, and they're not allowed to drink from it. That's what they're absolutely not allowed to do, and doing either of those two renders it non-kosher. There is a chumrah, I believe, of the shlo that does not want non-Jews even to look at the wine. And that's why some of the wine is sold only in tinted bottles for that reason. And what goes on in corporate America when they make this wine in some places, if it's made in a non-kosher house, is wild. I mean, they'll put up, you know, curtains, etc., so the non-Jew shouldn't even be able to see the one being made. But those are chumras. It's a chumra of the shlora. The chassidim are, well, their community observes. It is a chumra. But we don't always know, and you never know where the problem is going to arise. I was once, many years ago, at the Seder with our Rosh Hashiva Zatzal, it was in Eretz Yisrael, and I was a guest from one of the Rosh Yeshivas, but that Rosh Hashiva lived in Eretz Yisrael. So we had a first Seder, but he didn't have a second Seder. So for the second Seder, I was the guest of the Rosh Hashiva Zatzal. The Rosh Hashiva was in Eretz Yisrael. Now, you would imagine this should be the most secure place in the world, to have Yayin Chayin and Mavushim in Rosh Hashiva's house. But the Rabbeinu Shalom has the ways that he runs the world. The Rebbetzin Alei Shalom, and a whole strange story that's not for now, but she meets in the yeshiva a nun from Gaia on the first day of Yontov, who wants to find out how to get to Tel Aviv, so to get to the second, for the second night of Yontov, to go to the second Seder. So he's trying to find out how we can get, you know, the public transportation doesn't run. He wants to find out where he can find a cab. Oh, Kalponim, so the Rebbetzin Alei Shalom succeeds in convincing him to stay and to be the Rosh Hashiva's guest for the second day of Yontov. So he also came to the second Seder. And I'm sitting across from him. And, you know, the wine was on the table. He picked it up and he poured it into his cup. And the Rebbetzin Alei Shalom, ever astute, observed this at the same time that I did. And she waited a few moments. And then unobtrusively, she just picked up the bottle of wine and disappeared into the kitchen, never to return again. So you don't know where the problem is going to arise. But this is a very real problem, and we really have to pay a lot of attention to it. Because I said the problem now does not only touch wine, but it touches grape juice too today. So we need to be very, very careful, and to read very carefully. Don't make assumptions if something is mevushal or not. We'll be surprised how often it's not mevushal. Yes?
Is it not seeing wine enough to allow the support?
Is what?
If the wine bottle is wrapped.
They cannot pour it. If they pour it or drink it, it's all over. Finished. Yes.
This is even in the presence of the host?
Yes.
Meaning,
yes.
Oh, so this is not because you're afraid they're going
to
do something?
No, nothing to it at all, no. It's a takona that the Rabbanon made of Stam Yenim of wine that non-Jews were involved with.
So it can't be, they can't look at it?
They'll look at it, as I said, that's a Hasidish Chumra. It's fine. It's comes from the Shlah, they observe it. But what we Tzaradin, they cannot pour it and they cannot drink from it. Those are the things which are awesome.
So, you're saying a not from person is the same category as the
There's a major issue. Certainly, lechatchila, it should not be used with a non from people. Nobody would disagree with that statement. What to do after the fact, go ask your Rav Shaila. Most Rabbonim in the world would tell you it's osur, but not absolutely every single person. But that's, as I said, you have a Shaila, go ask your Rav. The lechatchila, there's no question that any rav in the world would tell you that when you have none from people present, you cannot have none of mevushal wine or grape juice.
So if they touch it first, then it's
not... Touch it means, doesn't mean the bottle. It means if they drank from the wine, touch the wine or poured it.
Touch the wine or poured it. And what if the host first poured their own, and
yeah,
then...
So when they pour, well, if they pour from it, then it will become usur. For anybody, if they pour from the bottle, the bottle's cooked.
No, I'm saying if the host pours for themselves.
Yes, and then?
And then the bottle's still on the table.
Yeah, and then?
They actually had this self-sucking, that's why I'm asking.
And then what happened?
And then the not-from-person took the bottle and
yeah,
poured for themselves.
So, okay.
The host is still okay with
Yeah, the host is okay with what he has, yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole interesting question, which I don't want to get into now, but it's a rather unusual shaila which has to do with that, which I once discussed with Rav Yoshua Zatzal. And let's say you're a Rav and you're doing a wedding and the chosen is non from. If you use wine which is not revushal, is it also for him to drink it too? Does he violate an Isa? Did I violate Lifnei Iver by giving it to him? This is a 20th century shaila. But it's a real shayla. But as I said, that's beyond the purview of our discussion presently. We're trying to take the high road to see that we stay out of trouble. So we need to ask ourselves first and foremost, what's the status of the wine and grape juice? We have mevushel or not mevushel, who's present?
I want to ask you something. So you said, let's say there was not mevushel wine, but let's say the chatan and kala are from, but the in-laws are not from, and so if they're not pouring it for us,
it's not what you should do lechatchila, but the ever, if they're not drinking from it, it should be kosher. But that's not for now. You know, yes.
One makes a sign. Like, I'm saying if it's sealed, it's okay, right?
Sealed is yes.
Is there any way to, like...
You can make a seal yourself. You could take tape around it and draw, you know, put letters through it so that nobody could open and close it and put it back into the way it was. You know, there are things that you can do.
So as long as you make some sort of...
But you need to do something. You just can't leave it in a way that you don't have control over the situation. Now, yes.
What constitutes a person who is from? Someone who's
Shomer Shabbos? Shomer Shabbos. If you're Shomer Shabbos, you're from. That's it. The rest is the Eibishter's business. That's not, you know, in that regard. It's up to the Eibishter to figure out the rest. So this is a major issue. Now, the question is, when non-Jews come into our house, do we give them the right or the responsibility, in fact, to use our utensils? So let's say I got around the problem. First of all, how do you get around the problem of Bishul Akum? It's getting increasingly difficult to get around the issue of Bishul Akum in a home setting today. Why? Because 25 years ago, pilot lights were ubiquitous. And Baruch Hashem, the Poskim signed off that, you know, if I have a real pilot light with a gas flame that's burning constantly, and when I open the flames on the stovetop or in the oven, it lights from the pilot light. So there's no issue of Bishul Akum in such a case. And right now I'm dealing for Ashkenazim, Sfaradim, it's more complex. But they made a discovery back about 25 or so years back. You know, when you start to consider what's actually taking place, they discovered that 25% of the gas which was consumed every month in a normal household was being burned up by a pilot light. So they came to the conclusion that this is not a very sensible proposition to burn up so much energy for no purpose whatsoever, other than that we shouldn't have to strike a match. Which led to the new technology that we use today. Today we have electric spark guns built in to the oven, so when you put it on, it sparks. And that the spark lights the gas. The only problem is there's no pre-existing flame. So now, if a non-Jew puts on the oven, it's Bishul Akum. And microwaves, it's generally agreed to. There are some that disagree, but generally agreed to by the great Poskim that there's Bishul Akum in a microwave too, if they cook something raw. So this is a major issue, and it's not so simple today to solve in the types of technology which exist today. So if you do want to resolve the problem, you have to do something which we're probably not so comfortable doing, and that is you have to put on the flame before you go away. So they have an existing flame. Now, most of us probably don't want to leave a flame unattended in our house. With all the things that might happen and malfunction when we're away, nobody there to, you know, monitor the situation. Something starts to burn, we're not home to smell it and go run into the kitchen and see what went wrong. But, so, it's not so appealing, this type of situation. Now, if Sfardim, in fact, have a whole different level of problem, because the Sfardish Shita disagrees substantially with the Ashkenazi position. And on the Ashkenazi position, it's enough that we light the flame. If we light the flame and they do all the cooking, the food is kosher. In the Sephardi position, the Jew has to do at least some of the cooking. Which means that either I put the pot under the fire or I light the fire under the pot. So when I light the fire, it starts to cook. But just lighting the flame and then the non-Jew to put the food onto the fire does not meet Sephardi standard. which is a major problem. In fact, one of the local yeshivas many years ago, I helped them arrange a situation that they should be able to accommodate the Bishul Akum standards of the Sephardic Talmidim of the yeshiva too. So these are issues now. If the food is pre-cooked food, and they're only rewarming the food, so then we don't have situations of Bishul Akum with that. But then we need to ask ourselves something else. We're still allowing them then to use our utensils, whatever they may be. Whether we're going to tell them to warm it up in the microwave, so we're leaving the microwave on. Whether we're going to tell them to warm it in the stove or the oven, but they're using our stove and our oven. Now, what's significant about that is the following. When I tell someone working for me that you can't do certain things, absolutely you cannot do them. So then I have a chance of monitoring the fact. If you break the rules in this world, you can steal once or twice and get away with it in this world. If you make a career of stealing, sooner or later they're going to catch up to you. Somebody breaks the rules on a regular basis, sooner or later, you're going to catch up to them. But if you allow them to use your microwave, your stovetop, and your oven, then you're never going to know what they did. Because the fact that it was used, yeah, you told them to use it. So how do you know what they did with it? So that's a reason that we really don't want them to be doing these type of things in our house at all. Yes?
When the Rav spoke about the difference between fire on the stove and electric utensils warming things like the hakapata, if somebody has an electric stove based on that fact, the ones that just turn on and the coils heat underneath,
yeah,
the glass, does that constitute not the same as Bishul in the fire?
It's exactly the same as Bishul. It's very interesting. There is, at the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, the great Peskim considered what was the status of using the incandescent bulb on Shabbos or Yom Tov. What's its status? Did it violate any halacha? So the first and most widely accepted approach was, the Rambam writes the following. The Rambam writes that if you take a piece of metal and you cause it to glow red hot, that you violate Havara, making a fire on Shabbos. So the Poskim, and this is many, many Poskim, we're dealing with Reb Chaim Oizer, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, and many others, Reb Henkin Zatzal, all held that this is a violation of making a fire. And the Magid Mishnah, the chief commentator on the Rambam, tells us that where did the Rambam take this from? Because we find in Shas that Shas has an expression, Gachelas, a coal, Shomatechas, made of metal. So you see, he said the Rambam learned from that, and it's literally considered like a coal, like a piece of fire. So putting it on is exactly, is making a fire, I'll be there, and it's real Bishul. Even microwaves, as I said, most posts come hold that are a violation of Bishul Akum too. Yes?
Is water,
One of the things, among the things that are mutter, are things which, like water, water does not have an issue of Bishul Akum to it. So, consequently, things which can be eaten raw generally don't have an issue of Bishul Akum to them. So usually it is not Bishul Akum if it's edible raw.
When is it?
Usually. I'm not thinking now if there may be some exception, but the general rule is something which you can eat raw, they would not violate Bishul Akum if they did. So we do need, if they're going to have responsibilities, so we first have to make sure that they don't violate Bishul Akum. Because otherwise we can give them glatt kosher ingredients and the house will be glatt treif. A significant issue. But if they're involved with our equipment, then how do we know what they did? So Generally, what I tell people to try to do is the following: is to set yourself up in a way that they should not be able to, you should not be allowed to use anything at all in the kitchen. Period. Don't give them kitchen responsibilities. Want to wash the dishes, you know, that's about it. Mop the floor. But in terms of anything, heating food, warming food, tell them they're not allowed to use any of the utensils, any of the stoves, any of the oven tops. Tell them your religion and your rabbi are very, very strict. And you're going to have all types of problems if they do it. So you're telling them, listen, this is one of the things they can't do in your house. Now, beyond this is another major question. What are they eating for lunch when they're in your house? What do they eat for lunch? You know, a mensch is nishkan malach, you know, so they don't come at 8 o'clock in the morning and leave at 6 o'clock at night and not eat the whole day. Now, generally speaking, the non-Jews have different tastes in food than we have. You know, go try to take a non-kosher facility, whatever it may be, and make it into kosher. The uproar doesn't end because they're used to eating different foods. So we have Ashkenazim and Sephardim, we don't eat the same way. We come from different places in the world. Listen, my family comes from Russia. If you want to know anything about root vegetables, you ask us. You know, in Russia, and the climate that existed in Russia, the champions were root vegetables. So potatoes were big, and turnips were big. Whatever grew in the ground, you know, whatever grew above the ground didn't fare so well. Whatever grew in the ground was big time stuff. The Sephardim lived in warmer climates. They have different hasagas. They ate more fish than we ate, and more vegetables, and more fresh fruits than we ate, because they lived in climates which were hospitable to those type of things. So every group of people, even within the same religion, depending where you come from in the world, has a different diet. And certainly people that are not in our religion have very different things that they eat. So by and large, most people really want to bring their own food, which is not a very good thing for us, because once they bring their own food, well, then there's a question what to do, to warm it up, etc. How do they want to eat it? They don't want to eat it cold, understandably. Best thing to do is to tell them that you don't want them to bring their own food. You'll provide lunch for them. You should ask them what they want and provide whatever within reason. But they should not bring any of their own food. If they don't bring the non-kosher food into the house, so you're already a big step ahead. Now, beyond that, there were things which seem relatively innocuous, but under careful consideration, they're very far from being innocuous. Yes?
Can we trust the guy that's not bringing
food? We'll come to that. I'm not up to trust yet. We'll come to that. That's going to be the final topic we talk about. Trust. Yes.
What about if you leave out like chicken to defrost, let's say when you go to work? Are they, if they touch it?
Nothing will happen to it. No. By and large, in the home setting, this is important. Within the home itself, the likelihood that they'll take away something kosher and substitute something non-kosher for it is about zero. It's a very, very remote possibility. What?
Is that the only reason we say we don't do it, that they make switching for
treating meat? That's one of the reasons. Now, the problem is something else. Let me explain what the dimensions of the problem are. Long ago, I was in Kailo, many, many years back. And one day, a guy comes over to me and has the following situation. I lived in Forest Hills. And there was a non-kosher bakery almost right downstairs from his house. The kosher bakery was about a half a dozen blocks away on Austin Street, near Continental somewhere. There was a kosher bakery in those days. So we had a non-firmer, a non-Jewish babysitter, and he asked her to go to the bakery on Austin Street and buy challahs for him. Comes home. There were challahs, but no identifying mark where his challahs came from. Now, this was beyond everything else. This wasn't a young woman, his babysitter. And to go marching off from Yellowstone Boulevard, corner Dartmouth, up to Austin and Continental was a good hike. Not something that, you know, a woman in her 60s was likely to do with relish. So now, what do we decide? Where did it come from? Did it come from, there's a bakery with challahs right across the street? You know, I lived once in Kew Gardens, and there was a takeout place. It had some of the most stunning looking challahs that you ever saw in your life. Absolutely stunning. The place was treif, but the challahs were beautiful. We need to ask ourselves, when we send them out for something, how do we know that which we send them for is that which we got? So, if we are going to send them to shop, then they have to come and bring it back in some type of sealed package, something that has an identifying mark on it, where they were, so that we can know where this came from. You know, bring back the receipt that you were in the bakery today, so we know that it came from there, something. They bought a piece of meat, a piece of chicken, how do we know where it came from? So we need to be on top of that too, because otherwise we have no idea, you know, what's going to happen. Now, this, as I said, there are things that are innocuous, relatively, from our standpoint, but they're halachically not so innocuous. So generally speaking, and that's where we get into trouble. When we take general principles and we extrapolate with them too broadly, that's where we really get into trouble. So everyone knows that to render something, bosom cholov or treif, so it has to be combined with something, either a utensil or food which is non-kosher, or it has to be heated. You need heat. If I took a non-kosher pot that's clean, and I put, you know, cold chicken soup into it, and I realize that half an hour later, I can take the cold chicken soup out, and the chicken soup is unharmed by the encounter. Not very pleasant, but still kosher. So this is a rule that we all know. The problem with this rule is that it has a major exception, and the world today is less sensitive to this exception. No, there are two ways that we know things in this world. We know certain things from tradition. We grew up that way. Our mother did it this way. Our grandmother did it this way. And if I ask someone what's the reason for it, they'll tell me, I don't know why, but that's the way it goes. That's the way you do it. You know, maybe they'll have to go ask the Rav. The Rav will have to explain to them why you're supposed to do it that way. But they know that's the way it's done. Sometimes we do things because of knowledge. We've learned that this is what's appropriate, this is inappropriate. Now the problem is, in today's day and age, by and large, we've replaced to a very large extent the Messiah from previous generations with learning things ourselves, you know, from books and from lectures and from discussions with people. But our Messiah is weaker than it was. And because of that, mistakes that our grandparents, our great-grandparents, and perhaps even far less learned in book knowledge in many regards than we are today, but they're mistakes they never would have made, which you can be a very learned person today and make that mistake. When I grew up, my mother, Allah Shalom, did everything the way her mother did it. You know, she did not have much chance for a lot of formal education. When she was of age, there were just about no There were certainly no girls' high schools in New York. I don't even know if there was a girls' elementary school, I doubt, in those years. You know, she learned a little bit in a high-class Talmud Torah of that time. She learned a decent amount for 2-3 years. But her knowledge was what she learned from her mother. And whatever her mother did, she did not change. Not one iota. Whatever she saw in her mother's house, that was Kodesh Kedosha. Nothing changed. So I grew up in a house that we knew. Without knowing being sophisticated in Yerodea, in the least. So we knew there were milachiks, there were fleishiks, and there was parv in the house. And if we wanted something for parv, so we had parv and knives and parv and things and whatever. We had plenty of parv and kalim in my house. Plenty. You can meet very learned people today who basically don't have parv and kalim. Because they decided, listen, what's the problem? I have to cut up some vegetables, so they're cold. So I'll take whatever knife, I'll make sure it's clean, and I'll cut up the vegetables, and that's all, and life will go on. I'm not going to use a hot knife for it. But that's where the knowledge misserved them. Why? In 95% of the cases, they're right. But the problem is where they're wrong. When we deal with sharp things, for example, onions, pickles, garlic, lemon, limes, just horseradish, radishes of various types, hot peppers. There we have different rules. Now, we suspend two of the main rules which keep us out of trouble in kashrus. What are two of those rules? Number one, if things are cold, there's usually no problem. Number two, if they hadn't been used within the last 24 hours, there's also no problem. So now I have a knife. Yeah, I cooked, you know, meat with it, hot meat, last Shabbos with it. But now it's Thursday, it hasn't been used in 5 days, and I take an onion and I cut an onion. It's cold, and it's more than 24 hours since it was used. But both of those rules get suspended when we're dealing with sharp things. That onion is now rendered fleishig. There are those that say that it's because I believe there's some sefer that it's this is not a chumrim even with the rabbanon. It's not a din derabbanon. It's a din deraisa. It's real boss. You can have real boss of a cholov. So now I take this, I took a fleishig and I cold and clean, I cut up an onion, and now I take it and ostensibly I'm making you know a par of a soup with it, but this is not a par of a soup. I'm making a milachik a soup with it. Whatever it is, it's, everything was cold and clean. What's the big problem? But this pot is now a fleishig pot. This pot is now a treif because it has fleishigs in it. So here's where knowledge doesn't always serve us well. You know, in life, certain things you learn by Messiah, as I said, from tradition. You learn them from previous generations. And if we combine that together with knowledge that we learn ourselves, then we're really doing well. But if we try to do it solely on our own knowledge, and we have to hope that we come out some tremendous type of goyin, that we get it all right. You know, a tremendous goyin can see the entire Torah in one fell swoop. And every single facet and factor is accounted for. But most of us don't see the entire Torah in such fashion. So we're a lot safer that we work with the Messiah that we have. And we combine it with learning, because mistakes can creep in that we misunderstood things in our Messiah, so we correct ourselves, and we learn some things which we just may not have realized that were part of our Messiah. They escaped us, so we stay out of trouble. So this is another major problem of what can take place in the house. Yeah.
If I would put that onion in a par of soup, in a fleishig pot, would one eat that soup? Would they become fleishig?
No, fleishig you won't become. You won't become fleishig.
You cannot eat it with milk.
You cannot eat it with milk. So you will not become fleishig from that onion. Correct. So, now, let's go to questions of what we call nemunas. Now, nemunas means trustworthiness. Now, trustworthiness has different types of definitions. There are business definitions of trustworthiness. You know, would I take $1,000 and give it to someone? Cash. Would I put it in his possession? would I put it in his possession? That's a business decision. Now, I may have non-Jewish employees in my business, and I trust them implicitly. I have long experience with them. And I said, I don't have a problem. I give them $1,000 cash to take care of something for me, too. That's, in a business sense, trustworthiness. But we're not dealing in a business sense with trustworthiness. Now we have to deal in a halachic sense. Who is halachically considered trustworthy? Now that's a whole different question. That is not dependent in my assessment of a person's integrity. That beyond, obviously, if a person lacks integrity, he certainly doesn't have trustworthiness. But beyond being a person of integrity, there are halachic prerequisites to have nemunas. Now, number one, a person that's non-Jewish to the largest extent does not have nemunas. Certainly no direct nemunas. Certain times, certain types of indirect testimony that he gives can be used in certain halachic contexts. But in terms of nemunas, halachically, he has no standing. A person that doesn't observe halachas, a person that's not, is to the largest extent also not considered one that has halachic nemunas, trustworthiness. There are some exceptions in dealing with that in the world of the Balei Tshuvas, but that's not for the norms that we need to establish. So for a person to be basically believed halachically, basically what we need is the following. We need that he should be a Shomer Shabbos. We need that he actually observes this particular halacha. Now, sometimes you may have a situation where a person is a non-Shomer Shabbos and is very strict about a certain halacha, and that you have to ask your Rav, there may at times, in fact, have nemunas. There are times that if a person has a great deal to lose and there's enforcement, so they could also be deemed trustworthy because of the fear of the loss that they may have from that. That's an issue. But to the largest extent, we cannot assume the halachic trustworthiness from a halachic standpoint of a person that's non-Jewish and non-observant. You know, yes, my personal estimation, yeah, there's a Hispanic guy that I know that if I could mal him, I'd make him a mashgiach tomorrow. You know, he works in a kosher place that I know. He is on top of his game. Nothing gets by him. He goes to the rabbi in his place and says, Rabbi, it was a delivery. I don't know what this is. Check this out. You know, nothing gets by him. And he's absolutely a person of integrity. But halachically, that's meaningless. It's very good for the rabbi in that place that he has such a person working with him. It helps him keep the place in order with a person that has, in a business sense, a great deal of integrity and knowledge. But halachically, it's not significant. Now, what do we have to do? So, as I said at the beginning of the shir, we need to set up hashgacha on our own houses. If we're not home, and we're not constantly in and out, if we go away for extended periods of time, that we're not going to come back immediately to the house, or it's very remote that we're going to come back immediately to the house. So then there's no hashgacha present. Now, we live in a world of nanny cameras today, and a nanny camera from time to time is not such a bad idea. You know, I can only tell you that unfortunately for many, what they've discovered on nanny cameras has been rather shocking. You know, when a guy discovers on the nanny camera that the non-Jewish person that's working in his house is observing him from the window when he's coming into the house and is acutely aware when he's coming and hides the non-kosher things that she's doing in the house, and the house, the kashrus is a travesty, and he has to kasher the whole house. Not very pleasant. But I'm not talking what might have been, I'm talking what has been, factually what has been, right here in this community. So we need to establish hashgacha on the house. Now hashgacha, at least at the very least, has to be what we call yaitzev v'nichnas. It means there's a concern on a regular basis that someone's going to come to check. That means we can give the key to someone else. Let's say my husband's not home during the day and I'm not home and I have a next door neighbor that's home. I can give her the key and tell her to come in sometimes. 2 or 3 times a week. Just pop in. Just walk through. just to show that, you know, things are under control. Sometimes come back even a second time in the day, just so the person doesn't know what to expect. Sometimes a third time even. You know, what do we know about security? That if it's random, it works the best. If it's not predictable, that's when it works the best. That's what we know about security. The security of kashrus is the same. So we need to establish hashgacha on our own homes. So this, yes?
What a big problem if, let's say, we have someone coming throughout the day, but not during a certain hour, we know the baby's sleeping, because then it might wake the baby up when
you can't leave a time when it's known that no one's going to come. They don't have to come very frequently at that time, but there should be no time that they're sure, they're secure, that people are not going to come. Or Rav Machshir, I said 20 years ago, about there was a huge snowstorm, probably one of the ones, the big, the huge ones in the late 1990s. So one fine Sunday, there was a huge snowstorm over Shabbos, Motzei Shabbos. He dug his car out, and he traveled a number of miles to the place that he gives Hashgacha to. When he walked in, the non-Jewish staff thought that they saw the Malach HaMavos. They were so shocked. They weren't doing anything they weren't supposed to, that's what I heard from him. But they were shocked. Today, the rabbi showed up. So why did he show up? He showed up for one reason, that they should never be secure that the rabbi's not coming. Don't count. It's a huge storm. There's 20 inches of snow in there, and the rabbi's never coming. No. Believe me, every other worker that worked on that I knew, the rabbi was here the day of the storm. He was here. Don't ever be secure the rabbi's not walking in the door. The rabbi's crazy. He'll come at any time and do anything, you know. And that's what you need. That's what you need when it comes to hashgacha. Now, the hashgacha, there's two types of situations. There are daytime situations when you're home at night and away during the day, which may happen on a normal business. Let's say you go away on a business trip, for example. And you have little children at home, and overnight you're not there. No one's there. For those type of situations, there's a different type of hashgacha that you need. It's something that I personally suspected long ago as being the truth, but it was... It's from a different sphere of halacha, but the issue is the same issue. I was asked a shayla by a person that they had an elderly father, a widower, and a widower, and he was an invalid, and he had a full-time caretaker, caregiver. To the largest extent, this full-time caregiver was a man. But every once in a while, the agency just couldn't find a man to cover, and they'd send a woman overnight. So it was an issue of yichud, what to do about it. So I had the opportunity, I sent the shayla to Rabbi Yoshua Zatzal, and he gave me an answer. The truth is, I'd used this type of solution myself in the past, but he added a very interesting perspective on the fact, because this was an overnight situation. He said what they should do was give the key to one of the neighbors and tell them that they should just march into the house and open up the door and march in. However, he said, since we're dealing now not with 9 o'clock in the evening or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but we're dealing at 3, 4 a.m., they actually have to show up sometimes at 3, 4 a.m. The people have to see that someone's actually going to come. I once did this years ago. A relative of mine had to go for a sleep study. And so that I called Tolly Mimazel, who is the technician that's on duty that day. You know, sometimes you go and there's a man on duty if you're a man. Sometimes you go and you're a man and there's a woman on duty, or vice versa for women. So one of my relatives goes to a sleep study. And he discovers that the technician is a woman. And he has to spend the whole night there. So I went over, he called me, I went there, and I spoke to the technician, and I told him, whatever, I'm going for, you know, explained a little bit what the issue was for us, and I said, I'm going to come a number of times during the night. And I drove, it was a distance. I went back, it was in the Bronx, it wasn't here. And I went either two or three times, I went up to the Bronx that night. So they saw, listen, you know, they don't know what's, you know, when someone's going to show up. So that's what you need when you're dealing with an overnight situation of Ashgaha, that someone actually has to show up some of the times at 3, 4 in the morning. So you need a good friend. You know, I have Baruch Hashem, I have some friends, not many, but some, that I could call at 3 o'clock in the morning and tell them I need you, and they'll be there. That's it. No questions asked. Sometimes you need a good friend. So this is a situation that we have to monitor. Now, let's just extrapolate a little to some, in the same sphere. Baruch Hashem, you know, when I was just speaking to a Rav today, and I told him when I went to yeshiva as a child, nobody had grandparents. Nobody had grandparents when I was in school. My grandparents all came to the United States before the Holocaust. But people didn't live so long. So when I was 3 years old, the last of my grandparents passed away. On the other hand, there were many boys in yeshiva that came from European families, and their grandparents, unfortunately, were victims of the Holocaust. So nobody had grandparents. My father, Allah mashallah, had a friend, and I would... So I would go, I was friendly with their children, I'd go with him sometimes to the house, and my father's friend had a father. His mother wasn't living anymore, his father was still living. And I just remember it was a strange thing, I just didn't know what to make of this. This was not my usual sphere of existence, like what it was, you know, I had parents, I knew. An idea of a grandparent was just not, as a little child, it was just not in my head. I didn't know what it was. I just didn't fit into my look at the world. What I'm getting at is Baruch Hashem was zeicha today, people live longer. And many of us have elderly parents. And there comes a time that they need caregivers. The caregivers are not always people of our faith. So we need to establish hashgacha in their homes too. To make sure, in fact, that the house stays kosher. Not so easy. It's a much more difficult task. Because then you may be dealing that there are help there, that they're there 24-7. And to the largest extent, unsupervised. It's a very, very complex problem. And one, unfortunately, that as much as we can do is usually is not as much as we would want to do or we should do. It's a very vexing problem. We have to keep this on the horizon too. Because this is part of what we have to deal with. So those are my basic thoughts. If there are any further questions, I'll take them now.
You mentioned the nanny cam. What was it? Does that help?
Well, it helps at least that you know what's going on in your house. So you'll be able to do something about it if something goes on which is inappropriate. If you're going to monitor it constantly, you have the time to sit and watch it.
I would imagine you could look more at that camera than like that occasional person coming in.
Yeah, but you need, as I said, you need to look at it. You know, most of us don't have the time to play it back. You know, when security cameras are used, usually what winds up happening is if there's a problem, so then they pull out the tape them and they play them back and they start looking through them. But it becomes a very cumbersome problem. And well, certainly if we're going to review them constantly, yeah, then it will certainly help.
Do you review them as often as any person who you'd be sending in? Like, does it have a halachic status?
I would say it has a halachic status, assuming that it well covers the area that you need to cover. You know, I would think that if you reviewed it on a regular basis, that would also, you know, satisfy. It's one of the things we use in the world of Ashgacha today. In many, many places, and increasingly so, we have video cameras. Now, you can sit in the Bar Rabbanim office, and we can go online and see what's going on in all types of establishments. Because we insist that they have cameras, and the administrators go sit in the office, just go on to their system, we have the logins, and watch everything that's going on in their place. So it's one of the things that the world of Kashrus uses today. Yes? You cannot cook for a non-Jew on Yom Tov. Furthermore, because of the fact that we may cook for them or insult them if we don't, we're not allowed generally to invite a non-Jew to our house on Yom Tov, if it's not Shabbos. If we have household or live-in help where there are employees, so we don't really have a social obligation to them in and of itself, they're not our guests in that sense. So from food that was cooked before Yom Tov, we're allowed to give them to eat. But a guest that comes, we cannot invite a non-Jewish guest even to eat food which was cooked before Yom Tov.
Yeah.
If, as I said, a paid help, we could give food which was pre-cooked before Yom Tov, yeah. Yeah. No, you could not make it. If they want, they could make it themselves. Now, usually, most of us, you know, for Yom Tov have hot water and it's usually up. But if you cook the water constantly, you could not cook water for them on Yom Tov.
So you could give them water from an urn?
Yes, that you could do. Yeah. You cannot, even if you've cooked it before Yom Tov, you cannot give it to them.
That's true. Can they
just stay on their own? Listen, you're not allowed to give it to them, you know, in any way. So, you know.
It's on the table and they want to take it, you say, no.
No, you don't have to, I don't think you have to chase them away, you know, but you're not allowed, you know, you can't set yourself up that they're going to eat from food that you cooked, that was cooked. A guest, we're dealing with a guest, not a paid help. Yeah, last question.
Can I just clarify the wrong answer? When she asked about the soup,
yes.
Was it flashing onion? Yes. So you can't eat it with milk,
but
doesn't the pot become
flashing then? The pot becomes flashing as a shiloh, but you don't have to wait 6 hours after. You don't become flashing.
And then the pot becomes flashing?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, two more questions we have time for. Yeah, go ahead.
Back to the nanny cam for a minute. There are some nanny cams that you record and then you can only watch after. There are some that you can connect to a computer or other device that you can watch. Even if you're not watching it as things.
You don't have to watch it as it goes, yes. But again, they have to realize that you're going to check on them. Now, you may not necessarily want to tell them how you're checking on them, so you're probably best off sending in a person from time to time. Because if they don't realize you're checking on them, it's of no avail. So, and you do have to tell them when you engage such a person, that tell them, listen, our dietary laws are very strict. I don't expect you to understand how to live by them, but, you know, I don't want you, you cannot deal with any of the utensils in the kitchen, etc., or bring your own food, and if you do, I'm just not going to be able to keep.
Can you tell them that
there's a nanny cam? Oh, no, you don't have to tell them. You can, the hashgacha could be that you're coming. If you have an obvious security camera that's up, some places have, so they'll know there's a camera. You see the thing on the ceiling, the globe. But you do have to tell them when they come, listen, you know, if you step out of line on this, I'm not going to be able to keep you in the employment. So that they understand clearly what the consequences are. Yeah, last question.
In a restaurant that's owned by non-Jew but has hashgacha as a mashgiach, and everything is done to dust.
No, there's no hashkafa issue. Listen, different people have personal standards beyond the halal, which is fine. As I said, I have no problem. You know, my Rosh Shiva Zatzal would not eat in a place which wasn't owned by a Shomer Shabbos. You know, that was a standard that he articulated. You know, you'd ask him, is that halachic? No, not halachically so, but just in terms of Zira Shemayim, that's what he was, and that's what he wanted to do. It's been a pleasure, Rabbi Yisai. May the Rabbanu Shalom grant that we zeicha to fulfill the halachas.
Mm-hmm.